I suppose there may be some who would suppose there's no connection at all between his concern for our nation being what it ought to be and my concern for our ability as evangelicals and our Christian tradition to change the world. And I think, although the general topic of our time together is change the world, in this particular hour of today, we're talking about the international dimension of that world in particular, since John Guest and Ted Ward and even Evie Hill was intended to speak about the things that are closer at hand. Now, that doesn't mean at all that I'm uninterested in the other thing. It just happens that my topic was assigned in this way. But the question which came to me as President Reagan was speaking is, in your own minds as well as mine, is there a relationship between the greatness of our nation, which I'm sure is God's intention that we be both good and great, and this larger goal, this larger challenge to us of changing the world, the entire world? I don't mean to say that he was unmindful of the rest of the world, but he too, like other speakers today, was naturally concentrating on the particular situation here in this country most of all. As I look at this topic, I feel there is a massive roadblock, a psychological roadblock, even to our consideration of it. And I almost feel that there's no use going into the subject if that roadblock is not first removed. I think, for example, it takes a certain amount of faith to believe you can change your local church. And John Guest was here today to say what he did to people who have given up on their own local church. I believe it takes greater faith to talk, as in some ways, as President Reagan has, about changing our country. That's a much bigger task. John Guest spoke of taking on Pittsburgh. What a exciting and vibrant and terrific challenge that is. Not just the local church, but the local situation. And I'm sure E.B. Hill would have gone further in that same direction. I was thinking to myself, it's too bad. I was really counting on him to draw the crowd out here, because he's probably turned down more engagements than I've ever filled. And it would have been a great blessing. And it would have taken faith to follow him and to believe that we can do something about our community. But I'm not sure how many people have enough faith to believe that we can really make a difference. All of the American evangelicals put together about the larger world. And I don't mean to be critical at all, but I am not at all surprised that this entire ballroom is not filled on this particular occasion, because this topic is the least credible of all of them. This is the one that for most people is tacitly, unconsciously, subconsciously given up as really and truly hopeless. So that my outline here, I've got a diagnosis and a treatment. My diagnosis has 3 points. The first point is that we have given up, and I want to deal with that. And then we've given over, and we've given in, and then come to the treatment and speak of 3 ways in which we can act to correct the situation. When I say we have given up, I'm only repeating what I said a moment ago, that most people in our churches today, when the subject of the entire world comes up, their minds gravitate in the realm of ballistic missiles or things like that, or the things they read in the newspaper, or in fact the things they hear about at church or even seminary or Bible college or Sunday school. And in none of those arenas of thinking today is there much at all of any real hope in the area of changing the world. I stand here almost like a voice crying in the wilderness against the media of today, from our Sunday school literature clear through to our theological seminary curricula, that have simply given up on the whole thought of really successfully evangelizing the world. Now, one reason perhaps is we haven't had the facts, but now we all have, I'm sure, our own copy of David Barrett's book, How many of you have ever even heard of this book, The World Christian Encyclopedia? Well, then you must read Time magazine, because two full pages in that magazine were devoted to this book. Now, what is this book, and what is so special about this book? I brought it. It wasn't any small task to bring this from California. I brought it to help you understand the significance of the Bible on the one hand and the impact of the Bible on the other. And there is no book that has ever been printed in human history that spells out in greater detail and in more comprehensive a way than this book what the impact of the Bible actually has been. We don't have the facts because Oxford University Press didn't get busy and promote this sort of a thing earlier. Now, 14 years and 500 people went into this book. And maybe you think $125 is a little bit too much for you to invest in a book that merely talks about the present extent of the Christian movement across the world. But what is more important than the impact of the Bible on the face of this planet? What book could you put on your living room table? Now, I'm not selling this book, mind you. I don't get any commission at all for saying what I'm saying about this, although it is a fact that David Barrett, who was the chief editor, is a longtime friend of mine. But I know the loneliness, the lack of help, the marginalization of his work across the years in that little office there in Nairobi, Africa, because the world is not even interested in what Christ has done. We think that's too big a question to ask, or we're afraid of the answer. What could possibly be the answer to this situation? Now, if you look in this book, you find all kinds of amazing things. One of the most quoted statements in this book is that the percentage of Christians in the world is declining. A very outstanding Christian leader recently quoted this in public, and it was quoted to me again by one of the media people here at the conference. And the assumption is, well, if after all these years the percentage of Christians in the world is declining, then what's the use of talking about changing your world? What is the use of pouring good money after bad if after all these years of sacrificial outlay, our missionary force has come to a dead end where the Christian movement in the world is actually declining in percentage? Well, now, first of all, those percentage points are in the tenths of percent, the decline. But in the second place, this is a global percentage. And in some parts of the world, there is one type of Christianity, which has been a state church Christianity. And like, say, in East Germany, the communists have successfully battered the church membership officially registered with the government down from 80% in all those years down to 60%. And so the percentage of fully registered official Christians in East Germany has been declining. There's no question about that. And the same thing is true all over Europe, especially when it turns out to be true you can pay a little less taxes if you can erase your name from the roll. But on the other hand, all over the world, the Christian movement is growing to beat the band, and I quote from this very same book, we have the paradoxical situation that although the percentage of Christians in the world has fallen since the year 1900, when at which time the massive amounts of Christianity were these state church traditions in Western Europe, nevertheless, the outreach, the impact, and influence of Christianity have risen spectacularly by something like 140%. I think of China. I was just recently figuring out that the growth rate of the Christian movement of China in the last 35 years, by anybody's figures, because there are, as you know, wide ranges of estimates, but the most minimal figures of growth in China would indicate that the growth of the Christian movement has been about six times the speed of the population itself. I say that again. The growth rate has been six times as fast, and the percentage, obviously, has been moving up, up, up in China. If you were to turn over to the Soviet Union in this book, you would find pages and pages of fine print merely listing the different Christian bodies in the Soviet Union that are still hanging on for dear life. And you would find an indication of their actual adherence at the present time. the date they were founded, the number of adherents, the number of local congregations, meticulous information which David Barrett accumulated when he was going around the USSR with government officials, the most detailed survey of Christianity that has ever taken place in the country of the Soviet Union. And after 3 pages of fine print listings of different Christian bodies that still exist in Russia, the total adherence at the bottom of that column is 96.7 million people in the Soviet Union. Now, I don't care what you thought was the case. There is no book on the face of the earth that speaks with greater authority than this one in terms of the impact of the gospel in the country of the Soviet Union. Now you say, well, but those people aren't all Christians. You've just talked about state church Christians and so forth in Western Europe. But I will say this, that state church Christians in Europe surely are a slightly cut above the rest of Europe when you venture across the Iron Curtain into that part of the world where it is such a handicap to be officially known as a Christian. Now, I don't know. The Lord knows what these 96.7 million people are truly like in their hearts. And evangelicals care about the hearts. But no matter how you measure it, even if you go out for Bible-believing evangelicals of the kind we would instantly recognize, you have a figure that is higher than at any other time in the history of that country. And, of course, the population of Russia is such that this is 36% of the population of Russia. It's a higher percentage than on the face of the earth in general. Now, the evangelical population is flourishing and growing also in that country. And what can the government do about it? They can do everything within their power, but they're unable to stop it. Same as in China, where they've recently taken the unprecedented step of banning prayers at any time and at any place except in the 100 or so officially opened church buildings where they think they can contain the gospel. What folly! We must feel sorry for the Russians and sorry for the Chinese if they really think that their only success is to beat this movement down. When we talk about changing our world, we must realize that God has been in the changing business for a long time, and we must not assume that as an actual fact that we have any reason to doubt that God can do what he said he will do in terms of taking the gospel to the ends of the earth. If I had time, and of course tomorrow noon at the lunch with the EFMA, I will go further on this very point. But we talk about the rise of Marxism and liberation theology. The rise of these things is faltering by any comparison to the Christian movement. The people who argue back and forth in the universities of Latin America are not capitalists and communists, but they're communists and communists. And the total number of Communist Party members in the world, 71 million, is probably far less than a third of the total number of identifiable Bible-believing evangelicals in the world today. Why are we assuming that this topic is a hopeless topic? We talk about the rise of the non-Christian religions, the resurgence of Islam and of Hinduism. But take another look. These movements have been profoundly affected by Christianity, and they are unwittingly and unwillingly, but nevertheless carrying with them new perspectives and new emphases which indicate the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ in their several locations in the world today, and in effect making it easier as well as harder for us to punch through and to make sense to these people. We talk about the rise of secularism, which, as in we've seen in Russia, merely purifies the church. It does not get rid of the church. And so I would submit to you that if we have given up, it is not because God has. It is not because the facts allow us to. It is because we have wiped out of our Sunday school materials, wiped out of our Christian colleges, wiped out of our seminaries, wiped out of our churches, the facts about what God is doing in the world today. Well, we've also, another problem in terms of changing our world, is that we have given the job over to the national Christians around the world. And I'd like to read a very fascinating transcript of conversation, a very recent transcript, between an ordinary Bible-believing evangelical and a denominational official. The official quotes the Division of Overseas Ministries policy guidelines of the National Council of Churches, the DOM, the Division of Overseas Ministries, assumes that the basic planting of the church has been accomplished. That is, the foreign missionary movement has now established the church on every continent and in nearly every country. Now, they go on to say, and so the man says, well, but I think there's an assumption here that's open to challenge. Well, now, the man goes on. Here he's not quoting, he's speaking his own mind. The point of view here expressed is that over a period of a couple of hundred years, the going out from the West established the church in almost every country. That was the function of the foreign Christian missionary movement. He speaks of it in the past tense, notice. And well, he might, because here's a statistic for you. Wycliffe Bible Translator sends out twice as many missionaries as all of the member denominations of the National Council put together. No wonder we're wondering whether we can change the world. Okay, going on. That was the function of the now passé foreign Christian missionary movement, the extension of the life of the church and the evangelization and the evangelism of the program of the church has now become the responsibility of the church in each place. Of course, if they're in the place. It is not that we have no concern for the extension of the life of the church, for evangelism, for establishing new congregations, etc. That's his word. The question relates to where the initiative rests and where the responsibility lies. His questioner comes back. I'd like to respond just briefly to that. This is an illustration. This is not just, and he quotes his denomination, that it's not just our work, because we don't work in Bangladesh, but Bangladesh has a population approaching 80 million. I think that's low. And this is only a recent document, so he's out of date on that. Of which about 0.4% is Christian. I think there is about one missionary for every 400,000 people in Bangladesh. I think it is asking right much to say to the Christians of Bangladesh, we're going to leave it to your initiative just to do the whole task. So the man comes back. Now, this is a quote. I'd say what you're saying is a very typical American response, but it is scarcely biblical. He levels the Bible against our initiative. And he goes on, it might be an interesting thing to have one of our executives for that area of the world to say something. So the executive comes into the picture. It's true. Your figures are correct. The Christian population in Bangladesh is very minimal. But there is a council of churches there. Big deal. The council is made up of Christian leaders of Bangladesh origin. I have been to Dhaka and visited with them and talked with them. They have a hard, hard job. But as Bob says, excuse me for interjecting the name here, there are a lot of Bobs, fortunately, the evangelistic work of a country like that needs to be done primarily by the people themselves. That's what they tell them. Now, we do have a massive program of aid, particularly. It started 2 years ago at the time of the terrible trauma that they suffered, and the result was that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of aid went to Bangladesh. Aid, meaning powdered milk and things like that, from the churches, from the Week of Compassion, from other groups. That we do. But in the ministerial, shall I say, the evangelistic work of the church, it must be done by the people themselves. They say that to us, and we want to honor and respect their request. Now, here I will give you an illustration. Suppose the only work that had ever been done for Christ in the United States of America had been done from Japan. Suppose the Japanese were the Christians and the Americans, the 230 million of us strong, were the non-Christians. And after a certain length of time, they had planted three churches, one in Los Angeles, one in San Francisco, and one in Portland, Oregon. Four. One in Chicago, too. And someone back home says, hey, we've planted a church in that country. We've got four different churches in that country. One probably would have been enough, but anyway, they've got four. So now it's the problem of those people to evangelize the United States. And so somebody says, wait a minute, four churches for 200 million people and so forth. And then they go on to notice that all four churches in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in Portland, and Chicago, according to my little make-believe illustration here, all of those churches happen to be churches made up of Navajo Indians. And they are supposed to evangelize America. They don't speak the language. They don't fit in with the cultural strata of this country. There are many worlds in America yet to be evangelized. And to say that a few people here or there can evangelize the entire country is to make mockery of the biblical emphasis upon peoples versus countries. The Bible does not say we are to take the gospel to all the countries of the world. Where do you find that in the Bible? The word country, as we know it today, is not really ever even mentioned in the Bible. God is much more concerned about this other entity of family life and family connections and linguistic relations and understood communication. And in any case, the target of the Great Commission, as the Bible states it, are the peoples of the world. Let me read on. So they call in a man from the mission field now to speak. He says, I am a product of missions. I grew up in a mission church, and my feeling is that, yes, there are millions unsaved, and there are a whole lot of these people in this country, and it is meaning the U.S., and it is your duty to preach to them. But to those outside of this country, we are willing to give our life to bring Christ to them. That is what we are supposed to do. And what I mean is, we were taught that if we are sinful, we go to hell. And we believed it. We're coming back to this country, and we're telling you that there are so many sinful things here in the United States that then you take out of this country to the rest of the world. This is just an extemporaneous thing, so it doesn't hang together grammatically necessarily. And unless you are able to teach your people that this sinfulness must end up, finish, you haven't any basis to take your gospel to the rest of the world. And he goes on giving some points here. Unless you are able to teach your people that this is sinfulness, and of course we have much to confess. We're a great generator of pornography and of all kinds of questionable media that flood the world, of course. And unless you're willing to teach your people that this is sinfulness to the point that they will accept and repent, not only accept it ideologically or rhetorically, but with pain in the heart and repent, until you are able to teach your own people in this country that this is not Christian, we wish you would not make an attempt to go out and save people. And he goes on to say other things of this story. He talks about a communist sermon he recently heard, and so forth. Well, the executive comes in. There is no advantage to be from the West, preaching the gospel somewhere else in the world. You don't need to send preachers to Zaire. There are preachers out there who can run rings around our preachers all over the place, and they are doing their evangelistic task. Again, the facts come into the picture. In Zaire, there are 200-mile-long ribbons of darkness between those centers where mission work has been done over the last 100 years. 200-mile-long ribbons of darkness running through Zaire where there are no preachers, there are no evangelists, and if the evangelists from Zaire were to go there, they would be no more acceptable than a Westerner because they come from other tribes that have been hated and fought and killed for 1,000 years. Who are we kidding that the people over there, whoever draws a line around it in a drawing room, that's what they do in drawing rooms in London or someplace, draws a line around, like in India, where you have 3,000 different nations within one country, and says, now, if you've got to work in the middle of India and you've been there for 100 years and you reached out for 50 miles in every direction, now is the time to go home. And this same denomination from which I'm quoting here has done that. And so this other man comes in. He says, now, I can't be sure what all these figures, where they come from. I do know that the most recent information which I have is that there is no country of the world today that does not have an organized, vital, growing Christian church. They may not be of our denomination and so on, but some of the greatest evangelists in the world today are Africans and black American people themselves. They are tremendous evangelists, and they speak to their people in a way that no person from another land can speak. Would that there were national evangelists within all 3,000 nations of India. But the record is that less than 70 of those 3,000 nations in India have any pastors, any evangelists whatsoever, any Christians at all within them. 2,900 and 29 nations of India have no internal witness. And the Bible, when Jesus came, He came internally. He didn't broadcast from afar, as good as and as helpful as that might have been. He came and sat where they sat. He spoke their language. He was one of their people, and he was from afar. And what did he give up to do that? And all over the world today, we have to be willing to give up to do that. And of course, the national churches overseas are participating in that. But to assume that the national churches over there are more responsible than the national churches here, we're all nationals. I believe in national pastors and national missionaries. Every missionary that's ever gone across the world has been a national Christian. And every missionary that's going to penetrate those 2,929 additional nations of India will be a foreigner to those people and will be a national Christian. And I might go on to say that, as I already said, I guess, that people locally are not necessarily the most acceptable. Try this out in America. Try to send a Navajo evangelist over to the Zuni or to the Hopi. You might do better to send a Filipino or an Indian from Bolivia, because those people have been working against each other for many years. So we've given up and we've given over. We've said, not here am I, send my sister. We've said, here am I, send the churches overseas to do the job. We've got enough problems at home. And we've also given in. These things really sort of work together. We've given in to a guilt. We've given in to a smear campaign, which even now in Guatemala is smearing every work of every evangelical. And these are called in today's paper the fundamentalists of Guatemala, who think of the Pope as the Antichrist. And so they elevate that up as if all 22% of that country has that same perspective. The evangelicals of Guatemala are the only hope of that country for anyone who's ever looked around the country. My daughter just came back after 2 months there. I lived there 10 years. I meet people every week from there. And you cannot follow the media as to what has happened. Has any media person ever learned an Indian language and gone out there and found out what those people have really experienced? Boy, the discrepancies between the reality and the public information about Guatemala is enough to make your blood run cold. Well, now, if this is true, we've given in to guilt, we've given in to ignorance, and we've given over to false solutions, what are we going to do about this? I, again, in my treatment of this problem, have just 3 points to make. First of all, we have to wake up. I'm not sure how many people at this conference here are aware of the fact that something like, and I wish I had more precise figures, we will soon, something like 30,000 missionaries from this country will be retiring or returning in the next 10 years. And something like 5,000 will take their place. If you think the National Council of Churches is going out of missions, take a look at the rest of the movement. Something like 30,000 will retire or return in the next 10 years, and something like 5,000 will take their place. Now, I apologize for not knowing more precisely those answers, but that is roughly the case. Nothing we're doing now will correct that situation. There has to be a revolution of perspective. We have to wake up. And I believe we have to face the facts that slipping out of the picture is the thing that will, as Reagan himself put it, is the only thing that will save our country. The real crisis, and I quote him, is not one which bombs and rockets will solve. It is a spiritual crisis. But I want to ask you very seriously, do you believe that our spiritual crisis is purely a national crisis? Is it possible for us to change our church, change our community, and change our country without reflecting upon the rest of the world? He said, if we cease to be good, we will cease to be great. And that certainly is true. But let's take another look at the Bible itself. The Bible does not tell us to be good, merely. It isn't good enough to be good boys and girls and keep away from evil things and keep out of trouble. That isn't what the Bible is asking us to do. The Bible is telling us of the grace of God in the blood of Jesus Christ shed for us. And it is asking us that on the basis of this blessing, we can take that blessing to the ends of the earth. And the whole Bible is on this subject. This is part of our problem. Our Sunday school literature, our study Bibles,
our talk about the Bible, we speak of the Abrahamic covenant without realizing that this is the Great Commission. We don't understand that there, when the Bible's dramatic story begins in Genesis 12, when God chooses a nation, He chooses that nation not only to bless that nation, but so that that nation can be a blessing to all the nearby nations. No, it says all the families of the earth. And that Hebrew word mishpaha isn't well translated family. It means the kindreds of the earth, and it doesn't mean the countries of the earth. And if some of you are wondering about the time frame here, you must remember that we were going to go until 5:15, which is 13 more minutes. I hope I can finish by then. Can we rediscover the Bible? This is how basic the problem is. I think many people carry around a Bible which is basically a medicine chest. Their Bible is a fix-it Bible. They maybe have a special section in the front that tells you when this goes wrong, look on page so-and-so. And it'll fix any problem. And people coming into the faith need a Bible like that in the hotel room. And they open it up and they say, when your marriage is falling apart, look at page so-and-so. But the Bible is more than a medicine chest. And then after we get at ease in Zion, we come to church and we find out that there are a lot of beautiful verses in the Bible that tell us about wonderful things, especially off in the future. And the Bible becomes a kind of a snack bar Bible. We go to Sunday school class, they pull it out of this level of the refrigerator, and they go to the church service, and the pastor pulls out another verse here, and these are all good verses. I heard that there was a Bible that had tinted in all the precious promises, called the Precious Promise Bible. You have to pay $5 more, but you can skip everything in between and save time in the long run. Our Bible is, for many of our people, a precious promise Bible. It is certainly not less than that, but it has got to be more than that. And then there are others, kind of head trip types, who look at the Bible a second time, they detect a few things here and there, and pretty soon the Bible becomes a recipe for the future. And they get caught up in this. And we have seen that in the history of evangelicalism. There was a time when evangelism was the reigning passion of some of our institutions. I'll not mention any names. And then there came a time when those same institutions were known primarily for their fantastic grip on the future, their eschatological predictions, the charts that they drew, and everything else. And I see now the charismatic movement going into that, which many other evangelicals had gone in and come out the other side of. The disciples were caught up in this. They had this idea they could just get a hold of the future. They could make their plans. And all the way through the gospel accounts, you find them trying to work out problems that Jesus didn't think were problems. And then finally, after the cross, after the resurrection, after that upper room scene where Thomas was doubting still, then they are there in Acts chapter 1. And having read their Peter Drucker books on management and so forth, they're flipping through their seven-star diaries, and they're saying, now, Jesus, they wouldn't dare asking him about when they're going to get power, you know, because they knew that upsets him. But they said, well, now, Jesus, just tell us a little about the future. We need to put the dates down so we can make plans. This is Acts 1:6. And then that verse that I grew up loving and appreciating and misunderstanding comes into the picture, and Jesus, with great heaviness of heart, I'm sure, says to those disciples, bright, dressed up, all ready to go, but confused still, he says to them, listen, you will receive power if it's power you want. And he said, hey, we didn't say anything about power. Well, you know, if it's power you want, you will receive power. But that will be when the Spirit of God takes over your life and sends you to the ends of the earth. There is incredibly and indelibly this recurrent theme from Genesis 12:3, all the families of the earth, to the very end of the Bible, this concern of God for all the earth. Now, the spiritual implications of this, not just the intellectual implications, are that if we turn away from the concerns of God, there is no salvation for us. Jesus said, seek to save yourself and you will lose your life. There is no more stringent warning in the Bible than this. Well, now, wake up is part of the problem. We have to wake up to the trends in the mission world, to realize that it's off the margin of our mainline calendars, and it's outside of our literature. It's outside of our thinking. It's outside of our awareness. What are we going to do about that? The second thing I would say is we have to move up. We have to move up in our priorities, in our own lives. We have to move up into the facts. And we have a poster, for instance, which you can get a copy of here. This is a larger version of it that actually tells you what the facts are. See all the blue there? Those are the millions and millions of people, 2.3 billion of them, who live within nations where there is not yet an internal witness. Now, in most cases, it's incredibly easy to establish a church within these nations if we would lift up our eyes to their existence. But these nations are among us. 88 languages in Los Angeles. They're under our noses, and we're not reaching out to them. This is no longer an overseas-at-home problem. This is a world problem, these frontiers. In the last 17 weeks in Africa and Asia alone, there have been 17,000 churches planted. But not one of those churches has been in a blue area. Now, maybe one or two have. 17,000 churches. I call them copycat churches. That's not a derogatory term. It shows how easy it is once the gospel penetrates into a nation to spread within that nation. And it therefore indicates how strategic it is for us to move up in our awareness of the strategy that's necessary and begin to focus deliberately on the frontiers. Now, I'm here to tell you that the EFMA is not unaware of this. Their entire conference last September was focused on this. And in 79, all of those agencies parceled out these peoples and said, how many are you going to reach, and how many are you going to reach, and so forth. And the Four Square Church, for example, said, we'll reach 100 of these peoples by 1990. The mission world is aware of this today. One scholar spoke of it as a tidal wave of new interest in the frontiers. And now I'm speaking to many of you who represent the churches. The churches simply have to move up and to catch on. Now, how is that going to be done? One way to do that is through charts like this. Another way to do that is to catch our people who are studying. That's the college students. I was in Pittsburgh recently where there are a number of students studying this study guide, 170 pages, and this book, which is 864 pages. These two things together are a complete four-unit college course which carries credit in almost any state of the union and soon in every state of the union, so that any student on any state university campus can take this course and get credit from it, maybe from Geneva College north of Pittsburgh, or from the local, say, Malone College near Akron, a Christian college that will give credit for that course, and they can transfer it in so that they won't waste their time and their money merely taking courses that were not born in a manger in any sense of the term. Our Christian students today, 90% of them, will never, ever cross the doorway of a Christian school. 3.4 million evangelical college students are in state universities today and will never go near a Christian school. We have to reach out to them. A second technique, which I believe is far more powerful, involves following the pattern of a vast number of Christians of Asia. All the way from southern India, across the rim of South Asia, clear up into Korea, there are people who are setting aside a handful of rice every day for missions. I first heard about this in detail from a church in western Burma. And people on our staff began to think, why can't Americans do this? Those people are sacrificing that handful of rice. Each meal amounts to about $5 a day. What American evangelical is giving $5 a day to missions? Oh, we can't afford it, because we're so wealthy. And I'm not joking. The wealthier you are, the more you have to spend. And the less you have left over. Those people are poor, and therefore they can do it. Well, you know, may the Lord bless them. But can't we at least do something? What about the loose change of our pockets? Now, I'm introducing you to a movement which has already been in motion for over a year. I have here three different prayer guides from that same movement called the Frontier Fellowship, which is an autonomous corporation. This is the World Evangelical Frontier Fellowship Prayer Guide, which is being adapted now for use in India, going back to where the idea came from, a daily prayer guide for the ends of the earth. This is the same prayer guide, same stuff inside, just a different cover. This is the Evangelical Free Church booklet. And there are people back in the back as you leave who can give you one of each, and you can tell immediately the common denominator are all the interior pages that lead people day by day through this new awareness of the ends of the earth and the possibilities. These pages sparkle with facts, with things happening right now, things happening in the past, and things that must happen in the future. Now, I brought this along for John Guest, an Anglican version of this prayer guide. There are some Anglicans and Episcopalians who are also using this same kind of mechanism to give them a new perspective of the world. Now, the concluding challenge I lay with you is this. Why can't we Americans, who talk so much about the churches around the world, try to catch up with them? Can we? Are we willing to join hands with them in this kind of a daily pattern? Now, maybe if you want to save rice, you can, or French fries or whatever. But I don't know. I think maybe loose change is the best thing. Now, you say we're already saving loose change for something else. Well, I don't care what you do. But if you will allow God to invade your life daily, and you as a Christian leader will help other people to allow their lives to be invaded daily, you will find the potential revolution of which President Reagan spoke and which I have tried to delineate more carefully. This is not going to happen by going ahead as usual. We have to decide whether we're going to finish up this job, whether we're going to reach all these people groups by the year 2000. A church for every people by the year 2000 is a not unreasonable goal. But I, as a United Presbyterian, must tell you that my church is not going to help very much in that goal if we continue to give, and I'll give you the exact facts here, and I don't do it to criticize my own church. My church is a relatively friendly, generous church compared to many churches. We give 2 cents out of every $100 to work overseas. And most of the work overseas we do has nothing whatsoever to do with the remaining pockets of people where there is no internal witness. I submit to you that God will hold us responsible if all we can do is give 2 cents out of every $100 of our income to the ends of the earth. My friends, this must not be. If we cease to be good, we cease to be great, we must be better than good. Good behavior, staying out of trouble, is not all that God asks of us. If we are going to change our world, we're going to have to give up many pastimes, many good things. We're going to have to put on a wartime lifestyle and to discover the fact that we really are in a war today as never before. And we're winning this war. That's the tragedy of it. One of the great battles in the Civil War was lost to the North simply because they didn't realize that they could have won it. They backed out of it. Now, I'm not taking sides in the war. I'm only giving you an example. If you don't know that you're winning, you will not do what you could do. Oh, I urge you to take with you today the optimism of the facts themselves, the challenge of the Lord of Glory, the theme of this conference, and don't settle to change your local church or your local community or your nation. Settle only for what the Bible asks us to do, to be a blessing to all of the families of the earth. I pray that will be possible for you and for your faith as it is built in this conference together with the other people.